Well, welcome back. Again, my name is Dave Dawson. I'm an alcoholic. Let's start back off with the Serenity Prayer again to get things back on track. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. So now we're on step four. We talked about at once. The decision, meaning the third step, was a vital and crucial step, but it would have little permanent effect unless we really took a look at who and what we are. And you know, for me, I really feel like the fourth step is where the rubber meets the road. Step one, two, and three, I find that most people are either there or they're not. And four requires some real action. I mean, taking a look at our lives, and especially when we come in with our lives so shattered and so wrecked, and the wreckage is, you know, it's substantial. And I kind of, when going through it, I go through the fourth step right out of the book. I've seen the different guides. I believe the 12 and 12 is a good tool after you've gone through the 12 steps, sort of in hindsight, to help enlarge and deepen. And this is just my experience. I mean, you may have a different experience. My wife would disagree with me, because her sponsor had her kind of incorporate some of the things out of the 12 and 12 into her step. But for me, I pass it on the way it was passed on to me. And as I see it, the directions, and this is the directions that I give guys I sponsor, they're pretty straightforward. Three lists. The first list is resentments, and they, you know, they give us a little example there in the book on how to do that, and they break it up into three columns. You know, you've got the first column, which is who, you know, the second column, which is really why, and the third column is sort of what it affects. Now, I didn't really get this the first time through, but I've sort of gotten in retrospect, and as I've continued to do the four steps, but there's really a fourth column that's not shown in that example, but is discussed in the text. And the fourth column is, what was my part? You know, and it talks in there about, often we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. And I'll give you an example of one of my resentments that really shows that very clearly. A guy that's one of my best friends towards the end of high school, a guy named Jeff. And I had a resentment against Jeff, so I put Jeff in the first column. Now, why was I resentful of Jeff? Because Jeff slept with my girlfriend. And I didn't find out about it for 2 years. And I was still with her, and I found out one day that Jeff had slept with my girlfriend, and I was pretty pissed at Jeff. Now, what did that affect? Well, it screwed up the relationship big time. I mean, this is 2 years later, you know? And I went looking for Jeff in a little bit of a drunken rage there, and didn't find Jeff, but I found his truck, so I beat his truck up instead of beating him up. Kind of alcoholic I was, you know? Beat his truck up. And I also knew some things about Jeff, some things that he had told me in confidence. And so I promptly disclosed them to some other people. Jeff had done some similar things to some other people that I knew with their girlfriends, and promptly spread the joy amongst the people around me, and to where Jeff was a very popular guy, and actually moved out of the area because he was so popular. Jeff sounds like a first-class prick, doesn't he? Really, doesn't he? I mean, if I stop there, in my mind, Jeff's wrong. I mean, what kind of guy, you know, what kind of friend, best friend does that? That fourth column says, what's my part? Oh, now it's going to get a little interesting. See, my part in it was, in a drunken blackout, before Jeff slept with my girlfriend, I slept with Jeff's girlfriend. So now Jeff doesn't look quite so bad anymore, does he? I stepped on the toes of my fellows and they retaliated. You know, and so that fourth column can really, in my experience, make a big difference when looking at the resentment. And you know, when I went through that list and made those, there were some resentments that I just didn't know what to do with. And I really believe that when we come to that, that's the real value of doing, jumping ahead a little bit, but the real value of doing the fifth step with someone who has experience with the steps. Okay, and the book gives us some leeway on who we do it with and all that. And also at the time the book was written, there wasn't a whole lot of us around. So, you know, I believe they gave us that leeway for a reason that often people misuse today. I've had guys that I sponsor say they want to do it with their psychiatrist or their psychologist or their priest. You know, and you know, I kind of share my experiences, you know, it's up to you who you do it with. But my experience is that if you're going to pick a priest, I know priests that have experience with the 12 steps. But and the reason I really think it's important that whoever we do it with have experience is because often, and it's been the case with me, and I think it's been the case on the other end as being a sponsor and passing it on, is sometimes we just don't have a clue with what to do with our resentments. But someone who has had experience with the 12 steps and taken other people's fifth steps have different perspectives. And often, you know, when I sat down with my sponsor, there was a lot of things that I really didn't know what my part was in it. There were things that were done to me that really, truly, I was, in a way, a victim that I didn't bring on, you know? And we all have some of those things in our life. But God knows, as much as I was a victim, I certainly victimized people. So I believe that although I don't believe in dwelling and being a victim of wrongs in the past, I also do believe in offering forgiveness as I wish to be forgiven. You know, so that's one of the things that came out of that whole resentment for me. Number one, it's important to take a look at what my part in it is. Number two, it's important that if I don't really know or understand resentment, to rely on a sponsor who has experience with the steps to help me, guide me through seeing my part, if there is a part, and trying to put it to rest. And really the third thing in the resentment is, as for those resentments where I really, truly didn't have a part, is to offer those people the same forgiveness that I wish to have offered to me for the things I've done, and there was a long list. So that's the first part, resentments. The second part is fears, as I see it. And it talks about listing our fears. Put them down on paper. I tell the guys, whether they're rational or irrational, you're afraid of snakes, write it down. You're afraid of women, write it down. You're afraid of success, write it down. You're afraid of failure, write it down. You know, and you know, what I find is that often, and in sobriety, that our life can be run on fear, even in sobriety. Once we deal with the resentments, fears are something that the resentments seem to fade pretty quickly for the most part, but the fears remain. And the solution to fear is faith. But as Tom said last night when he talked about, what was he said? I can't remember now. Trust. When he talked about trust, and when he said trust, he said faith is not enough. And when he said trust, what came to my mind was that line that says, faith without works is dead. That really faith by itself without the action is not enough. And so the faith with the works, you know, is in when we get trust. You know, it's deeper. And and so the solution to fear is indeed faith, but faith with constructive action. And that's what I found is that and somebody asked a question, apparently I'll touch on it briefly, and this is just my experience. There are different people out there. This is a kind of a controversial question. I'll pass it on to you too. Could you talk about, after doing the fourth step, do we need to continue to do it again, or is that what the tenth step is for? My experience is largely it's what the tenth step is for, except, now I have gone back and done another fourth. I've done many fourth steps on particular areas of my life where I've seen the same behavior, the same fears, or the same issues come up so repeatedly that it's just so glaring that it's time to put them down and sit down with my sponsor and go over them again. And so when I look back, and I saved my first four step, there wasn't a whole lot that was too incriminating there. I mean, there was a lot of junk, but it's amazing how little power that stuff has over me now. Whenever I'm getting ready to go through the four step instructions with guys I sponsor, often we'll do it at my house, and I'll pull out my list and I'll say, here, take a look at the top five. Do that, huh? Help set their mind at ease. Show them right off the bat they're not all that different. Some of the deep, dark secrets that we all hold, I just drop right out. Here you go. You know, the stuff that was my junk, the stuff that was my garbage, the stuff that I wanted to keep inside is now a tool to be used by God to help them take the action that they need to take. You know, that's the power of the garbage of my life is now that it can be used as the bridge from them to God. You know, what power does this stuff have? So fears, we write them down, and often they don't go away. Some of them go away quickly, some of them go away slowly. But as I've gone back the couple of times that I've went back and really redid a fourth step, and I look at that original list, and I'm like, God, so many of them are gone. So many of the fears that I had, fears like, I won't stay sober. Do you remember that? Do you remember when you really believed and doubted whether or not you'd stay sober? Whether or not alcoholism would kill you? Today I don't live in that fear. Today I really believe that if I keep doing what I've been doing, that I don't have those kind of fears anymore in my life. You know? The fear that God won't help me. That's one of the ones I have. Those kind of fears. They're big fears. You know? The third list is really talks about our sex conduct. And I kind of classify that into two areas. One are the things that you don't want to tell anybody. Right? And, you know, and that we all have that with us. And I found out that with all the fifth step that I've gone, though I don't know how many I've done, but I've done a fair number, enough to know that we're not, at least on the guy side, you know. I may have sponsored one girl, and she was a lesbian, so I thought it was okay. You know, I figured that the reasoning behind why she wouldn't want a woman sponsor may be the same reason why I wouldn't want, you know, why I wouldn't want a woman sponsor, or I wouldn't want to sponsor one. So I figured it was probably okay. It was brief anyway. She didn't last long. But, you know, the sex conduct that I just didn't want to talk about, you know, things like childhood sexual experiences or abuse or those sort of things, you know, they fall into the list of things you just really don't want to talk about. But I found as I disclosed them to my sponsor, that he had them too. And I found out with the guys that I sponsored, I disclosed them right up front to them, just to make them, set them at ease. And almost if they're not there, I wonder about them. And then the second thing, which is, which I think is really the bigger point of a sex inventory, and I don't know really if sex inventory is a good way to put it, is your ideal. What's your ideal? And the big book leaves us a lot of leeway there, because we're not to be the arbiters of what other people want. You know, and one of the big topics in Alcoholics Anonymous often is relationship, mm-hmm. Right? And so what I ask guys to do, and when they take that inventory, is start developing an ideal. What is it that you want? It's not for me to decide; it's for you to decide. But start putting down on paper, what is your ideal? You know, I knew what my ideal was. You know, I wanted to be a husband and a father. You know, I wanted to be in a committed relationship with a woman that I love. I wanted to be faithful to her. I wanted to have the love and respect of my family and my children. Now, that wasn't, you know, and that was, I knew that was the ideal when I started, you know. Now, I didn't move directly to that ideal, you know. I wandered around a little bit to try to find whether or not that was really my ideal. And that's very much what I believe I have today. Had that idea, and I'm faithful to my wife. I've been with her for almost 8 years, and I've been faithful. You know, that's a big deal for me. It may not be a big deal for you. But, you know, in trying to develop, what is it? What is it that I want out of relationship with the opposite sex? And then try to take steps. And what I have the guys I sponsor do, because this is often something that isn't done one time, but is a continual, and this is one of the things, my sponsor refused to talk to me early on. He really did. He would not talk to me about a particular subject unless I did an inventory on it. I bet for the first 6 months, maybe in the first year.
You were stubborn.
Yeah, still am. You recognize it because you have the same character defect. But it was really valuable, because as I'd write things down on paper, I would see, you know. So as if I went through a relationship and I was felt like I was treated poorly, and I found, you know, I'd sit down and take an inventory of what my part in it was, and I'd come away with an idea of, okay, well I chose this person, first of all, that's my part in it, and then I'd take a little inventory of what my behavior was like and what their behavior was like in that relationship, and it helped me shape an idea of what I wanted. You know, for example, I found out that I wanted a woman who had a big heart, who was caring and gentle and loving. You know, that was very important to me. And I also found out that I wanted a woman who was a spiritual equal and who was a mental equal. And at one point in my life, I didn't want that. At one point in my life, I wanted to be the dominant one in the relationship. I wanted to be the smarter one. You know, I wanted to be the one that sort of controlled things. And my wife and my relationship is not at all like that today. My wife is a very smart, very intelligent, very capable, strong woman. And she doesn't put up with my crap. You know, and so when I try to step into control of the relationship, she reminds me pretty quickly that I am not the one running the show. You know, and I'm grateful for that, and I appreciate that. And so although often things, when I first look at what is my ideal, that my ideal is shaped and refined through continuing to take that inventory of what I want. You know, and really what God wants. I mean, one of the things that I think is very powerful in inventory is that. It helped, and going over it with another person. I mean, taking inventory on my own is pretty much fruitless. But to sit down with someone who has some perspective on my life, who isn't between my ears where my disease is, and then to have that person offer me guidance, it's indispensable. So that's my experience with the fourth step, and just like we said with the third step, having this all written down is of very little use if I just sit there and hold on to the piece of paper and stare at it and look at it. And when I got done writing those things, it wasn't a relief. When I got done writing those things, I felt like a sick and twisted human being. I felt like just a horrible, horrible, horrible person. And I couldn't wait to get rid of it. And so in the fifth step, and as time will take over here shortly, that I believe 4 and 5 are coupled, that if I hold on to that garbage too long and don't disclose it, it's meant to be an ego deflating process. You know, it's not meant to be, you know, an ego building process. You know, it talks about deflation and death. You know, if you do take that inventory and you look like a wonderful person, I really wonder whether or not you belong in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, because our lives, the soul sickness of our disease, you know, takes us to places and causes us to do things that are horrible. And we know it. That's why we come here. You know, we know it. Tom talked about us being searchers. And he talked about that last night, being searchers. And I believe part of what brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous was the fact that I knew I wasn't supposed to live the way I was living. That the things that I did just ate at my soul, you know, until I just couldn't stand me anymore. And so I didn't come here with some idea that I was a wonderful human being who was misled a little bit by disease of alcoholism. I came here believing I was a person who had a twisted, dark soul and was in desperate need of help. So enough out of me on the fourth step. Tom, over to you.
Thank you, Dave. Well, continuing on with our saga. And like Dave, I used 3 columns in the big book. And there is a place for a fourth column, but I moved that into step 5. That's where it was with me. But it doesn't make any difference as long as you do it. That's all. Yeah. Pretty simple. Resentment. What is a resentment? Well, a resentment is having anger and sort of owning it. I am justified. Oh, yes, against that SOB. And I want to refill that anger in my justification. Oh, yes. Over and over again. You know, it's like watching a play in football. And got one of these guys goes out there and reaches way up in the air and catches the ball. And somebody hits him and wham, they cut him in half, right? And boy, I said, geez, that must have hurt. He's the way he got hit, you know. And then he played it back in slow motion. Oh, you see these helmets hitting right in the ribs, you know. That's the resentment, playing back the anger in slow motion. That's what it's about. And savoring it and tasting it. And then you add a little chew in, see? If I'm angry with you, well, I might say it's a 50-50 deal. She was partly wrong, too. Now I want to savor it over again more. And she was 60% wrong, and I was 40%. And by Saturday, she's 70% wrong, you know. And I'll get it down to maybe 99-1. Now I got a real anger. I've examined it in slow motion. And I've enjoyed the helmet hitting the ribs. Yeah. That's what a resentment is in my experience, to refill the anger. And getting some kind of pleasure out of being so righteous. It's a judgment by the unqualified me. I am judging her, and I can't even judge me, and I live with me. That's all it is. Don't make a big issue out of it. I love these people that come, I have issues. Oh, I thought you throw them down, flush them a couple times, and then get them cleaned out, and then talk to them. You know, issues. I'm so important, I have issues. Oh, wow. You know, you got the child within. Every time I got drunk, that little bastard got drunk, too. Okay, that takes care of that issue. Moving on. Issues is nothing but self-centeredness blown up. It's a big deal because it's mine. It's happened to yours. It's life. Like, poor Lyra. We cannot afford resentments. Or as I said, in refilling it, we distort the facts. We're adding to delusion again, aren't we? Distorting the facts. We're moving away from the truth. And as we move away from the truth, we move away from God, who is the author of truth. Now we're really on our own. I feel lonely. Yeah, you got a lot of resentments, don't you? Resentment will isolate you from other human beings. Because you're different. Oh, yes, I know. How do you know that I... Because I beat you to it. Oh, okay. I did that. Been there, done that, got the T-shirt. You're different. No, you ain't. No, you ain't. You just think you're different. And remember, your thinking's got you sitting in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You ain't sitting here waiting for the good humor, man. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. This is where we're at. There's no justified resentment. No possibility. You may think so. That's your business. I'm not here to tell you what to think. I'm here to examine for myself what happened and how did I feel about it. Now, if you're feeling all peachy cream and your life is just fantastic and it couldn't get any better, you know, that kind of stuff, you probably don't have to do any of this stuff. However, if you have a tad of discomfort in your life, maybe you may have to be doing some things. Like, why are you resentful? What was the base reason you came up with, Tom? What was the base when you stripped all pretense from it? Well, the pretense goes like this. I just want her to have the right thing. That's the pretense. And we strip the pretense off. It means I just want her to do it my way. It's for her good. I don't even know what the hell's my good. I was saying, what's for her good? Oh, yeah, that's wonderful. Wonderful. What a compassionate soul you are about her. Honesty. It's stripped away from honesty. That's what resentment really does. It'll lead, if we take all our actions from column one and all the effect, we try to get down to lowest common denominator. What do they all have in common? The big book talks about it in a general way. One of the big common denominators is fear. Fear of what others will think about us if they know the truth about us. There's a fear. If people knew that I was as incompetent as I really am, oh, that's scary. I'll try to project an air of competence and self-sufficiency, which is a lot of crap. I'm God-sufficient, which is the truth, or God-dependent, not self-dependent. See? That's the truth. It's okay for me to be less competent than I pretend to be, as long as I can be God-dependent, then the truth is available. But if I'm Tom-dependent, I have to project a lot. That's a nice way of saying lying. Lying. Where's your big book, Dave? Oh, and you got to watch the directions in the book. Never get carried away with the big book like I did one time. I was up at the convention in Maryland, and there was a girl I knew that was supposed to have four speakers talking on sex and sobriety. Yeah. And she had a couple of women and one younger guy to talk to somebody. Something happened to him. There's a real wide hallway, you know. This was about 5 years ago. Hell, I was 66 then, you know. So she says, her name is Maria. Maria says to me, Tom, they're ready to start this thing, you know. She says, can you do sex? I said, you're in the hall, Maria? She says, no, no, in the room. So I go in there, there's a couple hundred people in this room. I said, sit here. She said, no, no, you damn fool. This is the fifth. Oh, I didn't know. So we go in there, and I just grabbed a big book, and I went to the wrong page. I picked it up. It says, do not be discouraged if your prospect does not respond at once. Search out and find another alcoholic and try again. You are sure to find someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you offer. We find it a waste of time to keep chasing a man who cannot or will not work with you. So be careful what you pick up in the literature, you know, on the subject. Be very careful of that. I'm going to skip fear for a moment and come back to that. As far as I know, based on my experience, and I've never lived like a monk, there's only two kinds of sex, the kind we emit and the kind we don't. So the kind we emit is normal. Now we have the kind that we don't. It starts with most of us with some childhood experiences, which I've had. And when you look at nature, you find out it's not a moral issue. What it is, it's a space really in young people, in curiosity. Now, there are those in charge of morality who have used some form of morality to protect the young and use the punishing approach. You will be a permanent cookout if you do this or do that or you don't. That's what I call people who think they're going to hell. They're permanent cookout. You go blind. Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're blind. Yeah. I start looking around, see if I need any glasses. You know, I'm going to go on for a while. Anyway. You do all these kind of things, but it's what motivates that is really curiosity of the young. That's the underlying motivation. It has no moral issue at all, only that you wish to put on it. I believe in my life it is artificial superimposement of that which is against that which is natural. You look at the young animals that do the same thing. You know, you may say these two young animals are the same sex practicing. They don't know. So it's nature. So don't put something on it that don't belong there. Probably the ultimate sexual experience is an equal exchange of love for the purpose of mutual growth. Mutual growth. If it's one-sided, it may be fun, but it ain't going to last. It has a limited shelf life, so to speak. One of the conditions upon which it was started have been fulfilled. There are many young girls, for instance, that say, God, he just had a nickname. They never stop and listen. Never. They learn nothing about the situation because they won't listen. Many young girls get pregnant. It's not an accident. Not an accident. And they aren't bad girls. They're not immoral girls. They want to have something that they can be 100% sure will love them for the rest of their life. That's the underlying reason. It may not be the best of reasons, but it's the best they have available to them. And if you listen to enough of it, you'll find this out to be the truth. If you listen. But a lot of these guys with diplomas won't listen to them. They're too busy. That slot in the human brain that says, need information on this subject is already clogged. So it just bypasses it all, filled up. So in sexual matters, the big book is very open for that reason. Am I qualified to say how you should love? Assuming that sexual exchange is a form of love, an expression of love, which I think it is. Am I qualified to say how you should love? How often you should love? I'm not. If you are, that's your business. But I ain't. I think in this area here, both love and tolerance, as Dr. Bob suggests, this is a very good area in which to practice. Now, there are people who believe that they are harmed by sexual infidelities of partners, and that can produce a great resentment, unfaithful to me. The act itself, generally, is unthoughtful and almost inconscionable. But it happens often, not often, but it happens enough to be a recognized problem with that. We have resentments about those kind of things. She or he was unfaithful to me. So, we have to look at the commitment. What was the nature of the commitment to the party who feels harmed? Was it conditional? We don't know. I will love you only if you do certain things. It might be conditional. I will love you if you help me with my career. I will love you if you don't gain too much weight. I'm not making light of these things. I'm saying there are conditions. And you can't paint it with a real broad brush. Now, to develop a resentment, to have hurt feelings about it, is natural. To re-feel the hurt feelings is to build a resentment. And to have a resentment is like you taking poison and expecting someone else to die. It don't work that way. What do? Forgiveness. Offer forgiveness. That's the end of your hurt. The world says we got to learn to forgive and forget, and I think it's a lot of crap. How many of us have tried that and it fails? AA has taught me that we have to learn to forgive, but we don't have to learn to forget. For if by prayer and forgiveness we have truly forgiven, we don't have to forget, for remembering no longer brings pain. Is the AA approach. Remembering no longer brings pain. That's all I know about sex, and most of it I have to do from memory. Now we'll talk a little bit about fear. The basis of fear. What is Tom's basis of fear? Well, fear I won't get something I think I need. There's a good fear, right? Dave said, fear you want to get drunk again. I need sobriety, for God's sake. But when you reduce fear down to its lowest common denominator, fear is the absence of truth. That's what fear is. Trust is the presence of truth. Not delusion, truth. That's the antidote for fear. God is the author of truth. so it's reasonable to say that fear is practicing the absence of God. That's the basis of fear. I am in a situation, I'm going in front of the judge tomorrow. I have an incompetent attorney. I am going to go to jail for 136 years. You should live so long. What's the truth? The truth is, the judge is one of God's kids. The truth is, you are one of God's kids. The truth is, the defense attorney is one of God's kids, and the prosecution is one of God's kids. And if it's a jury trial, all 12 of them, or six as the state may vary, are all God's kids. The important thing is that you know that. It's not important that they know it. It's important that you know it. I know that these are God's kids. And the ultimate, God is in control of what happens here. And that's what trust is really all about. Yeah. And many of us have experienced that. Experienced it. Like recently. Recently. Right, Big Sky? Okay. Recently. So, fear is to practice the absence of God. And I was talking to Nancy a few minutes ago. We were talking. And I said, you know that your awareness of God is being close to you and within you. When you pray, it's a local call. That's how you know. If when you pray it's still a long distance call, you're practicing the absence of God. He's way out there someplace. See? Well, he's everywhere. And we said in step three, we would be directed by this guy, didn't we? So let's follow the direction. Be aware that this is God's universe. We are temporary tenants in his universe. We don't own anything. I've never seen anybody, God bless you, I've never seen anybody get buried with a big house. Mox will do. I've never seen anybody get buried with a big car. Or a portfolio of stocks, you know. Unless it was Enron. And that's very many a guy that economically anything. See. But it's the presence of God. That is the answer. And we have to practice the presence of God. Oh, that's hard, Tom. You practice the presence of anger, don't you? Change the damn subject. Change the subject. That's what we do. I guess we should move to five, Dave. Would you like to do five? Can we do five? Okay, that's what I was supposed to do. That's my turn? Okay, all right. We'll do five then. Okay. When we get over to, well, why do we really do five? The Zen truck driver gave me a reason for it. Yeah, I'm reading the book, and you know, Wally, the Zen truck driver. Right? I think he was a sixth grade dropout. He says, Flynn, you're immature.
I can't be immature, Wally. I've been halfway around the world. I ran all kinds of businesses. Maturity is a lack of experience. And as we know, I just told you all my experience.
He yawned.
Yes, right.
He was very impressed. And he says, Flynn, you lack experience. He didn't even hear me. He has hearing aids, and sometimes when I talk too long, he shuts them off. You know, I know. I mean, you know, we're sensitive people. We notice those kind of things. you know, but he's here in Ace Rowan. And he says to me, you have happenings in your life. You have no experience. Oh, shit. I knew he had me. I didn't know where I was, but he had me. He says, you have happenings. He says, unless you convert those happenings to experience, they are of no value. You are condemned to make the same error again. You must convert the happenings to experience. It's like converting a check to a cashier's check. You can put it in your spiritual bank, and then you can draw on it. Whoa. The Zen truck driver struck again. There I was. Boom. Natsy, I said, how do you do that, Wally? He says, you take your happenings, you say to yourself, Tom, what really happened? Not what did you intend to happen. Tom, why? Not what you bullshitted yourself about happened, because it pleased you. You know? What really happened? Ooh. And then he ain't done. And then he says, you got to say, what part did you play in it, Tom? Excusing all others. Oh, jeez. I says, well, that's got to be hard. He says, it's harder to live life without doing that. That's the reason life is hard. You're trying to live life without drawing on your own experiences because you never knew how to. And that's what step five's about. To take all your errors of the past and put them in a spiritual bank. And you can draw on it. And when you share it, other men and women can draw on it. It's a negotiable instrument now. Shit. I gotta go do this to examine all this stuff. And I did. And I didn't know how to put proper perspective on it. And that's the reason we share it with another human being. I could talk to me about all I want. And I'll probably lie to me again and say, you know, it's part of Curtis's fault. Or, you know, I did this, but Curtis did that. You know, we do that kind of crap, don't we, Curtis? Sure we do. We all do it. Some admit it, some don't, but we all do it. Tom's law. Yeah. What'd you do this for?
Well, I lied to Curtis. Yeah, that's true.
But what'd you lie? You know, I thought I was a liar. I go to confession, tell the priest I lied. You know, he gave me 3 hours, 5 hours, 3 hours, good act of confession. Every 2 weeks we could do that. We could swap tapes, you know. I mean, nothing changed. You know? This is different. This is not like confession. This is like date session. I suggest you go to a sponsor, someone who's done that. Get a little different perspective. See, the sponsor says your problem was not lying. You thought it was lying to Curtis. It wasn't. You had told Curtis you were going to take care of something, trying to be a big shot in front of Curtis. And you didn't have the time nor the ability to do what you told Curtis you were going to do. And you lied to Curtis, because you didn't get it done in the time frame you told him it was going to be done. Your problem is not lying. Your problem is big shotism. Now, if you become less of a big shot, the necessity to lie drops way down. Oh. How about stealing? End of your drinking, that you were making a lot less money than you made when you weren't quite as bad off with your drinking. Yeah, that's right, Wally. Did your spending habits drop back? No, Wally, they increased. He says, see, you don't have to be a CPA to figure it out. If your income is dropping and your expenses are increasing, what's going on? Is it a fire alarm or something? Oh, is it? I ain't here.
Oh. trouble.
Give her that phone. Just give her the phone. Thank you.
Okay. Hey, he ain't no different. Wally talks to me the same way. He's special. A lot of us here are special. All God's kids, you know. So my spending habits were poor. And why was my... I stole to make up the difference. Stole a lot of money. Not just a little bit. I stole money in denominations. They call it embezzlement. It was not in Washington to say it was a misdirection of funds. Yeah, right. It's called stealing here, right, Curtis? It's called stealing. Why did I do that? Underlying cause. Big shotism. I had to continue to be a big shot, even though my income didn't support that anymore. Ego. Stealing is not the problem, it's ego. Gotta be a big shot. If I don't have to be a big shot, I don't have to do all this buying of crap, do I? I'm just average. Cuts down on stealing. I don't think it stops it, but it cuts it way back. Cuts down on lying. I don't think it stops it, but it cuts it way back. If it stopped it, you guys wouldn't even recognize me. You know, who is that masked guy? They don't recognize him, see? That's the reason we share it with one another. It's not to or to embarrass you, none of that stuff. And you ain't telling me nothing I ain't done. So I don't get no news bulletins, you know. It's like reading a history book, for God's sake. Of course, at my age, history may be current events. That's the to show you how much we have in common. And why should that amaze us? I suspect we all had the same father, so we probably have some family characteristics. Doesn't seem too unreasonable to me. Not too unreasonable. But these are the reasons we do these things. You must get to understand in your heart, not in your head, why we do this. And you will move from here to here as we gradually do it. And as Dave says, you will find, as I have found, that all of us have similar results. The more you take new people through the steps, the more you get out of it. Isn't that unusual? The more you get out of it. That's the reason I like to work with new people. Oh, Tom, you're so wonderful. No, I ain't. I'm an excessive person, and it feels so good to be recovered. Not just sober. With you, I want some more. Give me a new guy. That's what that's about. That's what it's about. See? Feeling good. Having purpose, power, and direction in your life. Whoa. And very little of it is dependent upon me. You have nothing to add to you. Everything that you need for successful living was given to you at the creation of the universe. Through the fourth and fifth step is uncovered, discover the garbage you put on top of it so you can recognize you're a spiritual person, you're an immortal person, you're a child of God. Dave?
What? Wow.
When it comes to the fifth step, let me share my experience with doing my first fifth step, and then let me, I guess, share a little bit of the value that I find on being the other end of it. I was sober 3 months when I did the fifth step for the first time. It was a spiritual retreat, which I had never heard of, was a little bit afraid of, And my sponsor got me really to do my fourth step by basically setting a date for my fifth step. He said, about a month ahead of time, there's a spiritual retreat coming up. I think it'd be good if you went, and it would be a good time to do your fifth step. So that did two things for me. One, it set a date for when the fourth step had to be done. And secondly, it really nailed down when the fifth step was to happen. And immediately the mind went into gear. This poor nice old guy. Man, I really like him, you know? And I really don't want to tell him these things. And I, you know, the things that I didn't want to tell him came to mind right away. And we talked about the fourth step. And so over a period of a month, I prayed and I wrote and I prayed and I wrote and I prayed and I wrote. And I had it all down on paper. And like I told you, it was not happy, joyous, and free. It's not good stuff, you know? And I liked the guy, and he's a nice old guy, and I didn't want to really disappoint him in the quality of the character of the people he was hanging around, like me, and tell him this stuff. But he kept emphasizing that if I wanted to be free from the disease of alcoholism, if I really wanted a shot at not any sobriety, but recovery, I had to do it. So there was no doubt in my mind that I would do it this time. This was the difference between before. That there was no doubt in my mind I would do this fifth step. And so we started off, it was a Saturday morning, and we set a time. We walked out, and the place that we did it at was called Manresa. It sits on the Severn River, an old monastery, wasn't it, that?
It was a
Jesuit retreat house. It's now an assisted living house, but it's beautiful. Looked over the Severn River, over the Naval Academy in Annapolis. And it was a crisp, cool fall morning. I remember it very clearly. And we started off with a prayer, and I began to walk with my sponsor, and we began to talk about things. And what came out of that fifth step was certainly the things that I didn't want to tell him. And you know what I found out? They became, very quickly, they became kind of immaterial in it all. After we went through a couple, and he shared back that he had done similar things, all of a sudden it was like, oh, that's it? I mean, you know, kind of anticlimactic, really. I kind of built myself up in my mind to be much worse than I was. And but we got the one thing I want to talk about, and that's this step. We've been into some things that weren't, that I really hadn't thought would be a big deal. But as I began to share about them, suddenly they became very, very big. And I'll tell you about one of the biggest ones, my father's death. I really believe God kind of pairs us up in this fifth step. And, you know, I had gone to psychiatrists and psychologists and counselors from the time I can remember. Most of the time it was usually focused on, you know, my father's death and growing up without a father. And really what I hadn't, and I had never really gotten free from that. I mean, what these guys had told me was that when you really sort of healed from something like that, that remembering will bring sadness, of course, but it won't bring the knife in your gut kind of pain. It won't bring the emotional turmoil with it. It'll bring sadness, but it won't bring that level of pain. And the reason that I really had never gotten over it was because often we were focusing on, you know, I don't know, the psychological aspects of all this and some form of therapy. But these guys had never been there. They never had the experience. And I began to talk with Tom about my father. And I really didn't think my father was going to be a big deal. He was on the resentment list. Because recently in AA, when, you know, I was doing this fourth step, I was in a meeting and a guy shared about being angry at his father for dying and leaving him alone. And it like hit me like out of the blue, like, yeah, I'm angry at him. How do you be angry at a god? My father was a god. And the son of a bitch still is. You know? I'll tell you a little bit about that in the ninth step, but I'm being sarcastic, but you know, I was just told how great of a man he was, you know, and trying to live up to it was impossible. And so, in some ways, I had a tremendous love and respect for him and a godlike image of him. In the other ways, I hated his guts for leaving me. There was all this mystery around his death. He had volunteered for this mission that he didn't have to go on, and he was killed someplace that we couldn't be told about, a way that we couldn't find out about. And it was all cloaked in shadows and darkness. And only recently I found out the truth through a ninth step, through making amends. when I held my little baby girl in my arms. I thought the amends to my father were done because immediate pain had left. When I held my baby girl in my arms, when I was there for 8 years, I knew the love of a father for a child. And I knew that I owed it to him to find out who he really was. Because I knew one day, if I were to no longer be here, I'd want that child to know who her father was. As we began to talk about my father, the tears began to run down my face, and I wasn't a big emotional crier, you know, wear your feelings on your sleeve kind of guy like I am now. Found out later, it's just kind of always who I've been. I've tried really hard to mask it, and it just doesn't work. It just doesn't work, you know. And at the end of it all, you know, tears are running down my face, and my shoulders are slumped, and I'm just a mess. And my sponsor starts telling me about how his father died when he was young, and how angry he was at some opportunities that he had to be pushed aside, and he had to go and start ringing doorbells and working for a living to support his family because he was the oldest son. It's his job to do that. And so in 5 minutes of sharing what he'd been working on, what the government had spent thousands and thousands of dollars, what we had talked about hours and hours and hours, and psychotherapy was largely removed. I didn't really realize the power and the influence of it at the time. Only in hindsight that I could see the great healing. The other thing that came out of that fifth step was I wasn't too bad for God. My friend Virginia calls it being the unique. I talked about it last night. You know, I wasn't that damn different anymore. I really wasn't. You know, even though there was a good number of years between me and this guy that, you know what, on the inside where the rubber meets the road, we were an awful lot of light. And he had 9 years of sobriety at the time. And God loved him a great deal, and I knew it. It showed. And maybe, just maybe, one day I could be like him. And that's really what I've been trying to do for the last 12 years since I did that. You know, try to be a little more like my sponsor. Try to be a little more like the people who are walking the path. Walk a little lighter and a little freer. And that's what happened. The other side of it is getting to do a fifth step with someone. Do you remember the first time, if for those of you who have done it, someone asked you to do that with them? The honor that is? You want to trust your garbage to me? I mean, I was the kind of guy to borrow him. If you told me something bad, throw that away. Okay. There you go. I told you about Jeff. I held on to that stuff until it was prime to use. And when it was prime to use, boy, it came to the forefront like ammunition in a gun. And that's what I would do when people disclosed things to me in confidence, is I would save them. And as soon as they hurt my feelings or gave me any reason, I would turn it on them like a weapon and do all the damage that I could do. I have never disclosed one thing that someone has told me in this stuff in the last 12 plus years to another person without their permission. I have heard horrible, terrible, tragic things. Things not any different than I have done or thought about doing. I found out that not only am I not that different from my sponsor, but most of you sitting in this room are probably not any different than me. And I found out a little bit about the fathership of God and that we are part of one big family. And every time someone trusts me with their life and trusts me with their garbage, somehow I feel like, you know, God kind of touches me. When we talk about, you know, when I used to go to the psychologist and the psychiatrist, and I talked a little bit about it last night, about affirmation, about self-esteem, about these issues. What Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me, again, not from the inside out, not standing in the mirror and telling me I'm a wonderful human being, that I'm a winner today. That I'm worth loving. I haven't gotten it from the inside out. I found out I was a worthwhile human being when somebody trusted me with their garbage. I found out the value of my garbage when I shared it with them and I could watch their face lighten up. The stuff that I had been ashamed to tell him, I now share so easily because it holds no power. It holds no power. And if anything, again, my wreckage of my life is used by God as a bridge from the new person to Him. I just am the broker. You know, I'm just a broker. So my experience with the fifth step is that it is absolutely vital. It is vital that we do it, and it is even more important that we be willing to take the time, and it takes time. It takes time and effort to sit down and listen. The best thing I can do in a fifth step is listen and pray. To listen to someone else, share their life with me. And to ask God to please. I always start off with a prayer, and I ask God to please, please, give us the guides to help one another. And what I found is most of the people that honestly do that really changes me. It really does change them the way I was changed. And I get to be part of the process, and I get to be touched in it all, and we're out of time. So I guess we'll call it an afternoon and come back in an hour, huh, or so? Hour and a half.